So first of all, thanks for having me. It's the first time at Perimeter, and it's really a unique and wonderful place. Also, thanks for coming and listening to this talk. I'll try to make it worth your time. So I'll be talking about tensor networks, and I'll use them as trial wave functions for topological phases. So a short outline of the talk. Like I said, I will discuss tensor networks and trial wave functions, but also say a bit about fermionic tensor networks, and then apply fermionic tensor networks in the simplest situation in 1D, and we'll discuss fermionic matrix product states, how they tell us something about topological phases. Then we go on to two-dimensional systems, but we go back to the bosonic case for a moment, and we try to see if we can learn something about topological order and anions, or topological superselection sectors in two dimensions. And then finally, we end with a short discussion about fermionic topological phases in two dimensions. So first, tensor network states. I don't think I need to introduce tensor network states to this audience. So like you all know, there are three main types of tensor networks. There are plenty more, but like people usually work with MPS, PEPS, or MERA. I will restrict myself to MPS, the one-dimensional tensor network for gapped systems, and PEPS, the tensor networks for two dimensions. So above, you see the familiar pictorial representation of an MPS with closed boundary conditions. And the second picture is PEPS on a square lattice with open boundaries. If these pictures do not mean anything for you, you should say it at this point, because I'm assuming that you understand what they mean, and it's very important. So I think we can continue. So what were the motivating principles for the development of tensor network states? So they like originated, I think, in quantum information, and they kind of provided a new, fresh look at quantum many-body systems, or the low energy physics of those systems. And the driving force behind this entire evolution was entanglements. And the fact that you have that entanglement structure is very special in the low energy states of gapped systems, gapped local systems, but also computational efficiency. So an MPS and all other tensor networks are a very efficient compression of all the information of a vector in a big Hilbert space. And for this reason, you can actually use them to you can use them in numerics. So MPS is underlying actually a lot of very successful algorithms such as DMRG, TBD, ITBD, TDVP, and that's part of the reason why tensor networks are very interesting. So, but I will actually not be using them. Not most of the time, I will not be using them for numerics. I will actually use them in a different way. And for that, I just want to introduce the concept of a trial wave function. This idea is actually way older than tensor networks. So one of the oldest examples is actually the RVB state, the resonating valence bond state, as introduced by Anderson in 1973. So we see an example on the triangular lattice, where you have spin 1/2 living on the vertices. And the state is actually superposition of all coverings of the triangular lattice with spin 1/2 singlets. So these circles, or like the spins which are in one bubble, they are in a spin singlet. And you just, the true grounded wave function is a superposition over all possible coverings. Second example is the Laughlin wave function, which describes fractional quantum Hall states. And the reason why these trial states are actually very useful is not because they give you the exact ground state of the model you want to study, but because they capture actually the essential physics that is going on in these systems. And they provide an intuition. So the RVB state, this is not the exact ground state of some antiferromagnet, of some Heisenberg model on the triangular lattice, but it allows you to grasp what is going on in this kind of system. You can understand the topological order in it. You can understand like the concept of spinons, visons, like very important concepts in condensed matter. They actually all arose from looking at this RVB state. And then also with the Laughlin wave function, people have played with this a lot. And out of this came this concept of a composite fermion, where you can understand fractional quantum Hall as some integer quantum Hall effect of fermions with flux lines. So it's not really what is going on, but it provides you a way of understanding, of getting a feeling of what is going on in a very strongly interacting system. So we want to use tensor networks for the same thing. We don't want to write down the exact state, but we want to use tensor networks as a way of capturing the essential physics. So why do we think that tensor networks can do this? Well, because, like I said, they are very efficient compression of all the information. Namely, you only need to know these local building blocks. And so all the information about the state should be in there somewhere in these local tensors. And the idea is that if you understand these local objects, you should understand the physics. So, okay, let's now say a few things about fermionic tensor networks. So just to be clear, fermionic tensor networks are not new. I think they exist for over 10 years. But I just want to say a few things about them because we're going to use a slightly different formulation than this, than the original formulations. So most of the original formulations used like really single particle operators, like creation and annihilation operators to describe the tensor networks. But we're actually going to use what mathematicians would call in a fancy way a super vector space. It's actually not that fancy, it's just a vector space which has two orthogonal components, V0 and V1. And it's actually just saying that there's like a natural action of a Z2 group on the Hilbert space, which just means that all vectors which are in V0 are even and all vectors in V1 are odd. And then you also have this concept of a graded tensor product, which is just saying that if you take the tensor product of two graded vector spaces, it's again graded, and like you would all expect, two odd vectors give you something even, and even odd gives you something odd. So it's very natural. So far, this is not really fermionic. Okay, I forgot to mention it also just a dual space, which in a trivial way inherits the Z2 graded structure of the original space. So nothing fancy going on here except words. And then the fermionic nature comes really into play when you start taking tensor products and you want to like move things. You want to change things around. And that's really also where the fermionic signs in like creation and annihilation operators come into play. So basically what we're going to use a lot is this isomorphism we call F. So F is just the trivial isomorphism going from V tensor product W to W tensor product V. These are clearly isomorphic, and the isomorphism you use in the bosonic case is just switch the basis vectors. There's another choice of isomorphism you could make. It just switch it, and if it's a Z2 graded space, you can add signs depending on whether the vectors you switched were even or odd. So the rule here is just telling you if both of these guys are odd, you switch them, you get a minus sign. Just very intuitive what is going on in a fermionic system. And the same thing applies to vectors in the dual space. So this is just a different formulation of how to generate minus signs you associate with fermions. So and then you can just make fermionic tensors, just make elements living in tensor products of these graded the super vector spaces. And then we're also only going to work with homogeneous tensors, which is the subclass of tensors which have a well-defined parity. So in the sum, you're only going to stick to tensor products of vectors and dual vectors which have the parity. Which have a fixed parity, which is the parity of the overall tensor. So, okay, we have the vector space, we have the tensor, now we just need to contract stuff and we can make tensor networks. So we just need one, again, trivial operator, which is the C, which just maps bracket to an element of the dual space and original space to a number, which is just the inner product, we all know this. So again, nothing new. And then we have all the ingredients. Now, how do you make a fermionic tensor network? Just first collect all the tensors you want to contract. Just put them next to each other, take the tensor product. Second, you bring the indices, the bras and cats you want to contract. You just bring them next to each other using this F. This is going to generate minus signs. And then just apply the C, just, well, do the inner product. So a few remarks are in order here. So first of all, it's very important here that we are using tensors with a definite parity. So like I said, the first step is just take all your tensors and make the tensor product. So I didn't specify which order you should take these tensors. If you would have tensors which don't have a definite parity, then if I take first this tensor and then that tensor, and another person takes the opposite order, if you want to switch them and compare, they're actually going to start making entanglements. So this, what we're doing is actually switching things is a non-trivial gate. So we always have to work in the subspace where this gate does not make entanglements. And that's also the physical reason why we have a super selection rule in fermionic systems. If you were allowed to make a superposition of a state with zero fermions and one fermion, then if you just have two of these states and you start changing the position, you're going to create entanglement, and that's of course not a physical thing. So that's actually the thing that locality, you should always preserve locality. So you can make this, you can generate these minus signs only if you have an additional rule that you have to work with states that have a well-defined parity. And the same thing is going on here. So you can define fermionic tensor networks if you only restrict to tensors where you're not going to create entanglements by changing the order of the tensors. Okay. So we have now these rules for contraction. First thing, to define a tensor, like if I want to make a picture, I want to use my graphical calculus, I must say what order of indices I have chosen. And in that basis, I can tell you what the tensor components are. And I have to do that for every single tensor. But once I've done that, then every contracted picture also makes sense. I can just contract this, and the rules are clear. Just you know what that picture means. You can use the graphical calculus of bosonic tensor networks without any modification. Well, when you draw stuff. Of course, when you translate to computer or to some calculation, things will change. But things are going to change, but the rules are clear. Like this contract function, we implemented this in a computer. It's really, you have the normal contract function for bosonic tensors. The fermionic one is a simple adaptation, simple modification. It's as fast, almost as fast as the contract function for bosonic tensors. Another point that's very important is that if you start dealing with tensor networks in this way, you're never going to have to pick a global ordering. So why do we love tensor networks? We're never making actual state. Like even when you do numerics, you're never making the MPS itself. You're never going to contract first make the MPS and then do stuff. You're always going to contract in a much smarter way, which prevents you from making very big objects. But a lot of conventional formulations of fermionic tensor networks require you actually just make the tensor network, pick an ordering in the global object, and then see what minus signs you get and take them into account in numerics. So here, this is not necessary. Just generate the minus signs along the way. You could do TEBD with these simple things. You can just take the pictures that go along with TEBD and just do them with fermionic tensors. So actually, we've been doing that. We've been implementing algorithms to find fixed points of fermionic MPOs and fermionic Hamiltonians, and everything just works very, very as well as in the bosonic case. And also, this formulation is very convenient for fermionics for theoretical studies. All right, so let's now go to the simplest fermionic tensor network, the fermionic matrix product state. So I specify that picture. Two virtual indices, one physical, and I specified by saying, well, it has the components AI alpha beta in that basis. So I pick first alpha, then I, then beta. The fact that my tensors are going to be even just implies that I have this block structure if I is even, and I have this block structure if I is odd. So I think that's clear. I want the overall object to be even, so I have to make that choice. Okay, and I can start contracting stuff. As long as I don't close the boundaries, I don't generate minus signs. We all know this. Bosonic fermionic systems are very closely related in one dimension. The Jordan-Winger transformation just maps you from one to the other. But closed boundary conditions are a bit tricky. So as long as I don't have a closed boundary, I don't generate any minus signs and just contract all the tensors. If I want to close the boundaries, I have to move the beta all the way over to the left. And because we used even tensors, this is actually a very simple minus sign you're going to get. And after the complete contraction, the guy with closed boundaries has actually this parity matrix P inserted. The parity matrix is an object which will come back many, many times. So it just gives you a minus one if you have contracted an odd vector, and it gives you one if you have contracted an even vector. So this thing, if this would be a bosonic MPS, would not be translationally invariant. But because it's fermionic, it is translationally invariant. So what you're going to do, let's say you're going to shift by one side, then the IN on the far right has to come in the first place. But whenever we change vectors, we have these minus signs generated. So you can easily check that if you move the IN from the far right to the far left, you're going to generate a minus sign that is canceled by moving this P through the AIN. So these two signs cancel, and what you get is something purely translational invariant. So up to now, we always used even tensors. But there's no reason to assume that the ground state of a fermionic system in 1D should always have even fermion parity. So the question is now, a natural question is, can we make a translationally invariant MPS, and that's very important, translationally invariant MPS with odd fermion parity? It's very easy to do that. You just take your tensors, and you insert some Y. And that guy has odd parity, and then the total parity of that object of the MPS is obviously going to be odd, because you have a bunch of even guys and only one odd guy. And translational invariance implies that this Y has to commute with all the elements and with all the tensors of your MPS. So there's a very easy choice to make this happen. Just pick this special structure for your MPS tensors, identity tensor some other matrix, and Y tensor some other matrix, depending on whether the tensor has to be, whether the physical index is even or odd. And then you can just pick this big Y also as a tensor product of small Y tensor identity. And this guy commutes with everything, it's odd, and you will make a ground state which has odd parity. Now something peculiar happens. If you make this choice and you want to, now let's say, with these same tensors, try to make an even state, you'll find it vanishes, because you will have a trace over an even number of Ys, which is just a times, which is multiple of the identity, and you will generate this P, this parity matrix we saw before, and the trace of sigma z is always zero. So you find that the state will always vanish if you try to make it even. So like tensor networks enforce on you that you should make a choice. You should decide you want an even MPS or an odd. These are two distinct classes. You cannot, once you've made your choice, you're going to have to stick with it. Actually, what we find is that this special class of tensors is actually the most general thing. So there's a canonical form for fermionic matrix product states. And this is actually related to the statement that every MPS can be written as a sum of different MPSs. And the ones which cannot be split up are the irreducible ones. And then the statement is that every irreducible one has one of two following properties. The matrices AI span a simple matrix algebra, which is just the injective case we know from bosonic MPS. And these are like the simple, these would also be irreducible in bosonic matrix product states. But you also have the second possibility, and these guys, they span a Z2 graded simple algebra. This is like more, again, fancy words, but just saying they are of this form. And this is what we call the odd case. In this case, you will have an odd fermion parity. So if this would be a bosonic MPS, you would be able to split this. This would not be irreducible. You would be able to write this as a sum of two different MPSs, but each one of them would not have a well-defined fermion parity. And like we said, it's very essential to have a very well-defined fermion parity, because otherwise what you're doing does not make sense physically. So if you impose a super selection rule, you get an additional class of irreducible matrix product states. So what are these? These are exactly the Majorana chains. It's well known by the seminal work of Kitaev that once you define a Majorana chain with periodic boundary conditions, the ground state parity has to be odd. And you can do a similar analysis, put these chains study them with open boundary conditions, and you find indeed there are Majorana edge modes. It's like a twofold degeneracy, which is delocalized over both edges in these systems. So we can start looking at global symmetries, and this is very similar to the SPT studies and conventional bosonic matrix product states. And now you always find that these virtual symmetry actions which so you have a global symmetry action, which on the level of a single tensor intertwines to tensor product of two symmetry actions on a virtual level, which will cancel if you contract the tensors and just and in that way produce a symmetric state. So this VG, these virtual symmetry actions, they will actually always have a well-defined parity. And you can prove this also in the odd case. You can prove these guys always have a fixed fermion parity, so they're always even or odd matrices, which means they always have this block structure, the block diagonal or block off diagonal. So not a lot changes if you start classifying fermionic phases using this. What does change a lot is if you start putting chains on top of each other and you want to study, okay, what is the new phase? Then you have to take into account that if you multiply the greater tensor product of the symmetry actions, which is the symmetry action on the tensor product of the MPSs, if you start multiplying these guys, you will generate minus signs because you're working with fermionic matrices. So you see that the stacking formulas become really different. And in this way, if you do it with time reversal, you find that you can reproduce a Z8 classification of time reversal invariant Majorana chains. And this is actually very beautifully connected to the mathematics of like the periodicity and the representation theory of Clifford algebras over the real numbers. And I think this was probably known, but it just pops out of MPS very naturally in a very beautiful way. And you can also do spatial symmetries. You can look at the reflection symmetry. And you actually find also the Z8 classification. And you also find that it crucially relies on an intrinsic fermionic formulation of the tensor network. You would use a bosonic formulation, just say, well, do a Jordan-Wigner and try to study it there. You would get the wrong answer. So that's also very intuitive, because if you make a Jordan-Wigner transformation, the Jordan-Wigner transformation of the tensor product of two fermionic systems is not the tensor product of the Jordan-Wigner transformations of the original. So that's the reason why you get the wrong, you would not get Z8. Like, Jordan-Wigner does not commute with taking tensor products, and that's the reason why you would get wrong answers. Okay, so let's now go to two dimensions, but go back to bosonic systems. So I was talking about trial wave functions, the RVB state, the Laughlin wave function. Why are these so valuable? Because it's really easy to make excitations in these models. Just in the RVB state, just cut a dimer, you have two spinons. If you remove a dimer, you get two visons. And you get, well, like the seminal works on the Z2 topological order was, in these models was just originating from the fact that you can really make these excitations in a very simple way. The Laughlin wave function, very similar. You just deplete the electron density at a certain point. You just make a hole in the system, and that's going to be an anion. Just multiply the Laughlin wave function with some factor to do this, and you can start studying fractional statistics in the fractional quantum Hall. So if tensor networks are going to be valuable class of trial wave functions, we should also be able to do this. We should also be able to make excitations and study their properties. So first, in two dimensions, how are we going to study topological phases? We're going to use the same philosophy as we did in one dimensions. Namely, we're going to look at co-dimension one objects living on the virtual or entanglement degrees of freedom. So in an MPS, we did not look at the chain, but we looked at zero-dimensional objects, matrices, acting on the virtual indices. We're going to do the same here. We're going to look at operators acting on the virtual indices, so the entanglement degrees of freedom. And these are now going to be, again, one dimension lower. So they're going to be one-dimensional objects, and they're going to be MPOs. This is like a very natural argument that if the reduced density matrix of an operator doesn't change much if you grow it, which is what you want, then you can show that it must have an area lie, it's an MPO. So that's a very natural assumption that you're going to work with MPOs because you want operators that you can grow without changing the local structure. I didn't tell you what operators we're looking at. Of course, I can write down many operators acting on these virtual indices. We're going to look at the ones which leave this tensor network invariant up to some number. So we know that just like matrix product states, MPOs have this notion of irreducibility, we're going to look at the MPOs which you cannot write as a sum of other MPOs, well, or as a constant number of different MPOs. And it's also very clear that if you multiply two of these MPOs, if each one of them leaves this system invariant, like the product of them will also leave this invariant up to some scalar. So they actually form an algebra. So you can write the product of two of these MPOs. If these two original ones were irreducible, the product is in general not going to be irreducible, but you're going to be able to write it as a sum of irreducible ones. So you very naturally get an algebra of these MPOs. So if A and B satisfy the fact that they are a symmetry, not really a symmetry, but they have this property that leave the tensor network invariant up to a scalar, then the sum would also do that, and I can the product will also do that, and I can decompose the product in a sum of irreducible ones. And also, you have this very natural assumption that the dagger of every MPO should also be in the algebra. So we have this algebra of MPOs, and then this is technical, but there's a lot of powerful tools you can use to study MPS, like analytical tools. And if you apply it, if you apply these tools to MPOs, you can prove a lot of things, and you can actually relate this algebra structure to local tensor identities. And what you find is actually that the structure of fusion categories, which is like used in stringnet models or TQFTs, actually pops out of these algebras in a natural way. So you get F symbols for people who know this. You get pentagon equations, et cetera, et cetera. These are not things you need to assume. These are things you can actually derive. So that's very nice, I think. So okay, now we want to make anions. We want to make the real topological excitations. So we just consider a subregion of our tensor network. And in general, that we should allow for the possibility that some MPO string is ending in that region. We're not going to think about specific ending positions. Just it goes in the region and it doesn't go out. So that's the only thing. And then we're going to look at the MPOs that act on the virtual degrees of freedom around that tensor network. And again, we do not need to assume anything. We can just again show that this is again an algebra. And if you multiply this, you will generate F symbols. It's very technical, but in the end, it's all very nice. And you just find that these MPOs with this extra MPO going in the region. This is actually an algebra, and it's a C star algebra, and we know of this type of algebras. They are isomorphic to the direct sum of simple matrix algebras. So, and the natural conclusion is actually that every single algebra that's building up this bigger algebra is going to give you an anion. And why is that? If you just assume I have anions and I start braiding them, start moving them around, you get a lot of diagrams, and all these diagrams can be reduced to just the action of things like that on some region where an anion is. And then you have a very natural requirement that braiding should not change the superselection sector of an anion. So you actually are forced to the conclusion that all elements in the C-star algebra, also simple elements, should be an anion type. So, and now what you have is a simple algorithm you can do in MATLAB to just calculate all the anions. You can also calculate the topological spins, the S matrix. The computer does it for you. It provides a very nice physical interpretation, which is that actually anions are like entanglement superselection sectors. So charges in the physical system are the EREPs of the global symmetry. Anions are the EREPs of the entanglement algebra. So again, it's very much related to what people already know, like spins are EREPs of the global symmetry group. Anions are EREPs of some algebra on the entanglement degrees of freedom. And what you also see is that if you restrict this blue line to be trivial, there's always going to be a subalgebra which doesn't have a string. And so it's going to braid trivially with all the other elements. This is what people call in the math literature a Lagrangian subalgebra. And this is actually related to the fact that we have zero thermal Hall conductivity, so that we have capped boundaries, we have the quantum double, we have non-chiral models. And you can actually just see that it pops out naturally. So this leads you to the conclusion that if you're going to use tensor networks for chiral phases, you're going to have to use a completely different formalism. You can also use these MPOs for SPT phases, symmetry protected phases in two dimensions. The MPOs change, stay the same. The only thing that changes is that the PEPS now intertwines the virtual symmetry to an MPO. So that's the only thing. But the MPO itself is the same. And now we have tensor networks realizing all these different phases, and you can start using them as benchmarks to obtain benchmark results about what you would expect in the entanglement spectrum at the edge of such SPT phases, and how you would actually recognize an SPT phase in a real ground state you want to study. So these are just some plots. This is like a Z2 SPT, and you recognize the compactified free boson, I think, with R equals 2 in the entanglement spectrum, and you can just start looking, okay, let's assume this is just some wave function I have obtained via some variational method. How will I see that it's actually an SPT? And you can start analyzing anomalies in the spectrum, et cetera, et cetera. And all works very nice. And you can actually propose a lot of numerical tools to start identifying topological phases. Okay, so for my final topic, we're gonna stay in two dimensions, but we're gonna add in the fermions. So a PEPS, the picture is the same. Definition is a bit different, because now in my definition I have included a choice of ordering of the tensor, and I see I've forgot the physical index. So there should be an extra extra cat there with I. Sorry about that. So I also need to put in this choice of arrows, which is telling me what is a bra, what is a cat. It's very important in the fermionic case. Not as important in the bosonic case, but in the fermionic case it is important, because if I'm going to contract bra cat, I'm just going to get a number. But if I'm going to contract cat bra, I first have to switch them, which will generate a minus sign, and then contract them. So depending on my arrows, I will actually get minus signs. And so if I would switch all the arrows surrounding one tensor, this would actually generate this parity matrix surrounding the tensor on the virtual indices. And this is just this minus sign you get there from contracting not bra cat, but cat bra. And so if I would have a tensor network that satisfies all the things I want them to satisfy, then I can, by playing around with the arrows, I can actually generate the whole class of these tensor networks. And this is actually very reminiscent of what people call a spin structure in high energy physics. It's actually just some Z2 gauge fields, like the arrows are just some Z2 gauge fields, and you can just like do local gauge transformations. And so that's actually very reminiscent. We'll actually see the connection is a lot stronger in the next slides. So this is something new in fermionic PEPS. Fermionic PEPS, we also, if you want to look at topological properties, we're again going to look at codimension 1 objects. But now we have one additional choice, which is actually you can choose this guy to be the even irreducible type or the odd irreducible type. So in more physical terms, this can be like a Majorana chain, or it can be a trivial chain. And this adds another layer of interesting physics on top of the entire study. So this is just a picture with a lot of confusing sub-pictures. So these are just the rules we're going to not assume, derive. You can derive these rules. And actually what I want to show is that if you want these MPOs to have these properties, they should satisfy some local identities. And actually what you can show is that these parity matrices, they pop up everywhere. So you find that these are actually the only consistent rules that are possible for these codimension 1 operators. So if they move through a tensor, then there should be a parity matrix here. Otherwise, it's stuck. It cannot get through. And if it moves, the parity matrix jumps from here to there. So all these rules are completely fixed. And actually, they tell you that if you have an MPO on the virtual level of your PEPS, a closed MPO, you can only move it, or actually just create it, just create a bubble of this MPO and grow it, if it has an odd number of these parity matrices. And this actually follows from our choice of arrows, etc. And this gives us a second connection to spin structures, because we know that a spin structure on a circle, there are two possibilities, periodic or antiperiodic, but it's known that only the antiperiodic one extends to the spin structure on the disk. So only the antiperiodic one is actually the one that you can define over the entire disk. So also these MPOs should be antiperiodic if you can, if you're allowed to shrink them and actually move on the entire 2D plane. So that's actually something which we do not need to assume, but just follows from the rules of fermionic tensors. And again, we have a fermionic algebra of these MPOs. And everything just goes through, but again, you have to take into account that there can be Majorana modes, Majorana MPOs actually. And this changes the structure, adds more structure. So now, physical applications, you can just translate all the known fixed point models for fermionic topological phases in this language, actually even more. So the supercohomology phases were already known. and you can use these MPOs to study physical properties. You can just make a torus, a certain MPO along some line, and that's actually that has a physical implementation of introducing a flux. So you have this cylinder and introduce a flux through the cylinder. But this is a discrete group, so it's like a discrete flux. And then you can start studying how do the endpoints of the flux, like the defects, how do they transform under the symmetry? And you can just derive these formulas in terms of supercross cycles and additional structure. I mean, it's not important what it means, it's just important that once you know the tensor network, you can actually get physics out of it. You can study how the defects behave, et cetera. You can also just make a parity defect, which is just a defect in this spin structure. And you can say, well, this localized defect, how will my global symmetry act? And you will actually find it also, it acts projectively on this parity defect. So this is also something physical that you can get out of these tensor networks. So we want to get, like I said, we want to use tensor networks to understand physics, to understand, get an intuition in the same way as RVB and the Laughlin state did. And this is like starting to get close in a way. Once you have the state and you understand the state, you should understand the physics. And that's also what's starting to happen here. And then beyond fermionic string nets, beyond fermionic SPTs, you have the models which have these Majorana MPOs. And what you actually find is if you want to make these like on a torus, say, you find that if you have periodic boundary conditions in both directions, it is forced upon you that you should make the state odd. So schematically, if you just, well, the square, the torus, opposite sides are identified, you find that in order to make it non-zero, you should introduce this red line, which is a schematic representation of some MPO going around the torus, and you should close it with this Y. And this is very closely related to the fact that the Majorana chain with periodic boundary conditions was odd. This is the same effect actually happening here, and it's actually forcing you an odd fermion parity ground state in the torus. And this is actually very similar to what happens in the P plus IP superconductor, where you also find that there's a very intricate interplay between spin structure, boundary conditions, ground state parity, and the number of ground states. And it's actually very nice that you get these things from, without using a single particle picture, without using anything actually just other than entanglement. You're just using the structure of these entanglement degrees of freedom in the PEPs, from this you derive a physical property like what is a ground state parity, how many ground states you have if I have these boundary conditions. Okay, so to conclude, tensor networks can be used as trial wave functions, and they actually can give you more intuition about strongly interacting systems if you work hard enough. It's not trivial, but once you get, it's like some, you have to get up the hill and pass some critical mind of technicality, and once you pass that, you actually get the physics out of it. So how do you do it? Both in one dimension, two dimensions, bosons, fermions, you're always going to look at entanglement degrees of freedom, and actually so co-dimension one operators acting on these entanglement degrees of freedom. And they contain the universal physics of this particular phase, quantum phase you want to study. What is very nice about tensor networks, we should not forget, is that there's always a fruitful interplay between theory and numerics. I only showed one slide with this spectrum of the SPT phases, entanglement spectrum, but also I mentioned like new possibilities for fermionic tensor networks and how to contract them, how to do numerics with them. And most importantly, finally, we're also currently working to generalizations to three dimensions. So this general reasoning, where you look at co-dimension one objects, look at entanglement degrees of freedom, also just equally well works in three dimensions. It's of course harder. The pictures are not going to be that nice. You have way more possibilities. But again, in principle, there's nothing stopping you, and we're also doing that. Just finding the best sub-problem you're going to tackle first and then understand. But we're doing that, and it's actually, I think it's really going somewhere, and I hope to maybe have some results in a year or so. So, okay. Thank you for your attention.
Any questions for the speaker?
Yes.
Sorry, I think I missed. At some point, you mentioned that it was a particular sister algebra that you obtained the mm-hmm. anion information from. Mm-hmm. Was that the MPO?
Yes. So that's the algebra, which is just this MPO on the boundary, but now with this additional like orthogonal MPO, which goes through it. And I didn't say what this is, but you can derive what it is. And this is, again, if you now take two of these MPOs, you're just going to connect the black lines again, and you also connect the blue lines of the two MPOs, and you can show that this again forms an algebra, actually a C star algebra.
Does that provide like the whole information about the annual system, like
yes.
The grading and the fusion?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So this is actually related to, we found out afterwards that this is actually related to some math result of Ognanu, where you like calculate the quantum double using like some algebra. So this was already known in the math literature.
So as you explained, the merits of this whole research program is that you can somehow visualize all these algebraic structures
mm-hmm.
that are, if I understood properly, all of them were known, but you can refresh them in terms of entanglement degrees of freedom.
Yes.
So is there a scope for finding new solutions based on, I mean, you already mentioned that maybe three dimensions will be the place
mm-hmm.
where there will be surprises, but in two dimensions, is there anything that is this framework leading to potentially new solutions that were not understood?
Yes, so actually I think already in two dimensions with fermions, this was definitely one of the first systematic approaches towards that, where you incorporate, like the fermionic string nets were known, but like taking the Majorana into the entire story, I think this was one of the first cases where it happened, but there was also similarly work by Kevin Walker and some guys from California who did a more formal just fusion category mathematical treatment of this, which is like was around the same time. But I think like that is where something new, I think,
but
has happened.
I guess I'm trying to understand. So you make it very explicit that you place the action in the entanglement degrees of freedom. You have this tensor
mm-hmm.
network where there is a natural place for this entanglement degrees of freedom, which is just the Bohr indices
mm-hmm.
of the
mm-hmm.
pairs. But is that formulation somehow equivalent to other formulations? Is that understanding of, you know, how this maps back into formulations? Because if that's understood, then it might be easier to identify what can come out of this formalism that was not known.
So I think in the SPT case, these MPOs have a clear physical interpretation. They're really domain walls. And they're like these topological field theories which tell you how the action changes if you introduce fluxes in domain walls. There, the two formulations are very closely related. Like every picture you make, you can translate to a picture which in the topological quantum field theory will give you some number for it. Like there's a very close connection there. And so I don't know what other formulations you might be.
For instance, if I look at this drawing, I understand that you're talking about a two plus one dimensional
mm-hmm.
system on a lattice. You're talking about a wave function.
Mm-hmm.
But if I look at the drawing and I get confused for a second, I could think of, you know, Kitaev's toric code. I mean, obviously that's a very
mm-hmm.
simple case, but
mm-hmm.
Any generalization of that, where what we would be looking at is strings of operators and
mm-hmm.
how they interact with the fixed point Hamiltonian,
uh-huh.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So at the level of the drawing, I know it's not the same, but at the level of the drawing is the same. And then if I think about these equations that you get, pentagonal inequalities and so on, they are in one-to-one correspondence with the ones that,
mm-hmm.
so you obtain them and they obtain them, right? So I wonder if that's just a coincidence or it means that maybe there is a systematic way of taking whatever they say,
okay.
whatever you say, into play. And if that's the case, then there would be no room for new results.
Exactly. Yes. Okay. So the strings you would draw as physical operators in like a Kitaev quantum double model, they are really the anions, and they satisfy more properties. They should satisfy hexagon equations and stuff like that. Here we actually only need pentagon. This is like some primordial structure, more basic structure, and applying this algebraic thing gives you the real anions. So the strings I draw are never the real anions themselves. So that's really a basic difference. It's like it's on a more, fundamental.
The endings are at the end of the string, right?
Yes.
And your excitations are also at the end of the string.
Yes, indeed. But you should say, okay, I understand what you mean. But the labels of the strings are not the labels of the anions. It's like really, that's like if you do Fibonacci model, the string would be one or tau, but the anions would be like, well, one tau times one tau conjugate, so.
I think I understand. So you're saying in your wave function, in the wave function formalism, these are definitely the final labels, the ones, the collective, the immersion.
Yes.
Whereas in streamline models, those are just a microscopic model.
Exactly. So, and I think, so I know there are a lot of fixed point models like string nets, like these cohomology models, but this is actually one step, the tensor network one is actually one step closer to the physics, I would say, because having a Hamiltonian and finding the ground state is one thing, but then, okay, it's solved, you have the ground state, but then, okay, now how do you get the physics out of the ground state? And that's actually what tensor networks allow you to do. So, like I said, like this one picture, where I say, okay, in fermionic models, you know now how defects work. This is something like, I had never seen this formula before, but now we check this as a two-co cycle. This is like, this is really a predictive statement. I'm not going to say it's has that many applications because, of course, these are very exotic phases, but still, like formulas like this can help in other theoretical work where like people study microscopic constraints and topological phases. They use how defects work and stuff like that. This might help you in making some microscopic constraints to realize a fermionic SPT phase in a particular model. So there are definitely things coming out of this which are new, I think, and which, at least to me, allow you to have a more intuition about these things.
Any further questions? All right, let's thank the speaker. Yeah.